Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. More than half of the nation's public school students are home today and will be tomorrow and for the foreseeable future. That's more than 32 million kids, a drastic step taken by governors and school districts to reduce the spread of coronavirus and flatten that curve. But schools are the beating heart of their communities. They provide so much more than academics. They provide food for families in need, specialized services for children, a sense of belonging, and a loving community. So we'll talk about how to keep all of that going in the midst of a pandemic. This hour on Point, coping with school closures and coronavirus. And we'll start today with Dr. Nathaniel Beers. He joins us from the nation's capital. He's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on School Health. He's also the president of HSC Healthcare System, which serves children with complex needs in the Washington, D.C. area. Dr. Beers, welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. I wonder if we could just kind of first start off with some basics that, you know, people might be hearing that regarding this particular coronavirus, children aren't getting as sick or infected at the same rates as adults are. So what is the logic behind all of these school closures we've seen in the past couple of days?
Sure. It's a really hard decision. I think, as you said, the preliminary data that we had out of China suggested that children were not getting the virus at the same rates as adults. It is hard to know if that is actually true or if, in fact, kids were not as symptomatic as adults and thereby did not end up getting to the threshold to get tested. And so we know that with viruses, that children certainly are often vectors of those transmission, and they do, tend to spread, partly because they tend to get in each other's space a little bit more, partly because they tend to share things more frequently than we may as adults. What we know is that we wanted to make sure that we created opportunities to reduce the transmission. And so schools have been thinking about kids as the vector. In addition, the challenge for schools is that you have to also think about the adult personnel who work at the schools. And so it is a broader challenge for schools who have an adult workforce and a child population who they're serving in trying to balance all of those and make sure that they can address the needs of the broader community at whole.
So given where we are right now with where the U.S. is in terms of how many known or reported cases we have thus far, do you venture to hazard a guess as to how long schools that have been shut down might stay closed?
It's a really hard question. I think that the CDC put out some really great information last week in helping school districts start to think this through. It depends a little bit on communities and whether or not they've had community transmission. As we think about those communities that have had community transition, many of them have initially started with either 2 to 4 weeks of closures. But as we gain more information about what that community spread is going to look like, we can expect that school districts will have the additional information to work together with their public health officials to make sure that they are making a decision that is going to be in the best interest of the broader community, which includes the schools and the kids in them, but also the sort of broader community of individuals living in that district.
Well, we are talking about the fact that half of America's public school children are out of school at the moment due to school closures. in the wake of the coronavirus global pandemic. And if you're listening and you're in one of those communities where schools have been closed, what's that been like so far? How is your district coping? If you're a teacher, what are you doing? If you're a family who relies on schools for certain key services, how are you finding those services now? Now, Dr. Beers, you know, I just mentioned that families rely on a lot of different services just beyond academics from their schools. Can we talk about that a little bit? I mean, how much do schools provide in their communities that may be hard to replace?
Sure. I think the biggest thing that we forget about occurring at schools is actually school meals. And so we know that those kids who receive free and reduced lunch are at high risk when school closes. What I know many jurisdictions are working through, and I'm proud to say that DC is one of them, that we've been able to see schools start to figure out how to provide school meals and support for nutrition for children, even when they are closed. And there has been some movement on the regulatory front that has allowed school districts to be able to recoup the funds that they have for those, which is different than it was even 3 years ago. I remember when I was the chief operating officer for DC Public Schools and we had Snowmageddon in 2016, we decided to reopen schools for feeding before we opened it for instruction. And those were funds that the school district had to support themselves without the federal support for that. And so being able to tap into those resources is really critical. In addition, we have to remember that we have many schools that also provide additional wraparound supports for the kids who are in those schools. So, for instance, our special education population are receiving therapy services, whether that's speech therapy, occupational therapy, as well as counseling services to support kids in getting through school. But many of those kids need those services in order to be healthy in their general lives. And so when school is not open, that gap in service really becomes more pronounced. Mm. The behavioral health needs of our kids are often supported in our schools. And during this period of anxiety and where there's additional stressors on families, we know that there's those additional challenges there as well. And then also, there are many schools that are using community health models to talk about wraparound services for the parents.
Right.
That are also in those school buildings, and those are really critical pieces to family survival as well.
So let's take a couple of those in a little more detail. For example, nutrition, as you were talking about. I mean, do you know in your area how, if kids can't come into the school building to get those meals, are they being distributed to homes, to other distribution centers? How is that working?
So in DC proper, there are 16 schools that have been set up to be able to support those families and allow them to come in and get feeding from the hours of 10 to 1 so that families can come in and get that support, and we'll provide those services as a school system locally. And I know that in Montgomery County, they are planning on making announcements later, early this week, to again support families in similar ways. And I've heard of several other jurisdictions around the country that are also doing that same type of thing, trying to decrease some of the traffic by making it a wider range than just a half hour for lunch, but acknowledging that the school can't be open all day long. And we don't want people sort of tracking through all the time.
Right. So we're going to, throughout the course of this hour, we're going to talk with superintendents from several different school districts across the country to get a real granular sense about how they're dealing with this in their communities. But Dr. Beers, I mean, there's also the question of learning.
Right.
Is there a risk that that children, especially in communities that already have certain other challenges built in, right, that they may be further set behind by being out of school than their peers in other communities?
For sure, we can expect there to be some additional challenges in recouping lost learning, right? We talk about even in the summertime when kids are home during the summer, what is often referred to in educational communities as the summer slide, where kids who have made progress throughout the school year slide back academically in that 8 to 10 week period that they may be home during the summer. And so you talk about extending that out during the actual expected learning time of the school year, and what that means. And I think it will expose the gaps that we have as a country in access to internet, as well as Wi-Fi access and cellular access throughout this country. In both urban and rural areas, we can expect to see challenges. We are going to challenge our broadband capacity as a country in extreme ways during this period as people are trying to work from home, go to school from home. And we are also challenging our teachers to really rethink and reimagining how they're providing instruction. And so here in D.C., the schools are having professional development today for the teachers to provide some support for them to think that through and to make plans and to think about, what about those kids who can't get online? What about that elementary school kid who's not necessarily going to sit through a 1 hour lecture in front of a computer effectively and actually learn?
Right.
How do you think about sort of engaging with that child and that family? And then how do you acknowledge that not every household is going to have the luxury of having an adult sit down and do instruction with that child on a day-to-day basis?
It's a huge issue, right? Because not only there's that point you made about, will every household have an adult able to sit down with the child? Internet access, as you were saying, if a lot of this learning is going to move online. And then I'm also thinking, you know, to your other point about younger learners, I can't imagine that kindergartners, first or second graders, that just the sheer way they learn translates to an online setting, even if they had access to it very well.
Yeah, in fact, we know that the data is out there that suggests that screen-based, what families think is it may be instruction, in fact, because of the lack of bidirectional communication, that in fact kids don't learn as well when they have high volumes of screen-based learning early in life, right? And so how do you create some of that balance, acknowledging that we are in a different space right now?
Yeah.
And make sure that we're wrapping back around to reinforce that learning, and how can we do that?
Excellent point. So the question is really, how does the catch-up happen when school finally gets back in session, whenever that might be? So Dr. Nathaniel Beer, stand by here for just a second. We are talking about the fact that half of America's public school children are out of school right now in the wake of the coronavirus, and what districts are doing to cope with that. We'll hear from superintendents when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about coping with school closures as half of America's public school students are out of school today and for the foreseeable future as the nation tries to do its best to flatten that curve in terms of slowing down the infection rate of coronavirus. I'm joined today by Dr. Nathaniel Beers. He is a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on School Health. And let's go to our calls. Vanessa is calling from Auburn Hills, Michigan. Vanessa, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
A little stressed, like many of the teachers here in America.
Go ahead. Tell me more, Vanessa.
So right now, we were closed on Friday, and our district basically told us to try to make three weeks worth of lessons for our students. And we also have a large majority of our students without internet access. So we were in today. We're not even sure if the school was cleaned, and we were making copies so these could be picked up by parents and students later on today.
Oh, so actually like paper copies of lessons.
Yes. So everything's online, and then we also put everything into paper, and we made about 40 copies for each course.
I see.
So really needed to do this for all our kids without internet access because it's such a problem. We probably have 20% of our population who do not have laptops or computers to use.
Oh, interesting. And Vanessa, do you mind if I ask what grade you teach?
Yeah, I teach high school.
Okay, high school. But is this happening across the district as a whole?
Oh, yes, it is. And I think from elementary schools are, you know, the teachers, especially lower elementary, are really struggling with what to do. You know, it is difficult for those children to learn in an online environment. And I can't even imagine, like, what they're doing for these next three or more weeks.
Yeah. Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for your call and for your work there in the schools at Auburn Hills, Michigan. Well, let's turn now to Kenmore, Washington, where Michelle Reed joins us. She is the superintendent for North Shore School District. North Shore closed its schools on March 4th and scheduled to be closed till April 27th. There are about 22,000 students and 2,100 employees in 33 schools there. Michelle Reed, Superintendent Reed, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna.
So your district closed earlier than most other school districts in the country that just closed either Friday or today. So you're out ahead of this. Can you give some folks some advice on what they're likely to encounter in the next couple of days?
Absolutely. I think I would like to start by just remembering what's important here, and that's our health and safety mm-hmm. of all of our students and staff. And also what we've shared with our district is to practice patience and not perfection.
Yeah.
We're not going to make an entirely new system overnight to match the system we've been able to nurture for many, many years. So I think, as Dr. Fauci said, we're not going to be doing things today that we did several months ago. So we just have to embrace this change and look at it as an opportunity to nurture new skills for our students.
I think that's an excellent point, right? These are definitely extraordinary times, Superintendent Reed. But it's a teaching moment and a learning moment. So really do guide us through what those first couple of days were like in terms of we were talking with Dr. Beers about getting services out to families, getting meals, nutrition, that kind of thing. What was it like there at the North Shore School District?
Sure. Well, what we did is we closed school for a day in early March to provide our teachers with a day of staff development so that we could have our teachers that were very proficient with technology teach all of our other teachers and staff who maybe weren't as proficient, so we could bring an entire school system up to scale online. And so our first week of, if you will, Classroom to the Cloud, our initiative actually went fairly smoothly. As you mentioned, meals and childcare also became a priority, so we created a survey for our parents, and they had to let us know if they either needed devices, mobile hotspots, or in some cases meals, as we're the only source during the day for food for some children. We had a number of families respond in all cases. We've distributed over 4,000 computing devices, 600 mobile hotspots, and we're serving food at 22 locations in the school district. What we realized is some of the locations some of our families couldn't get to, so we've actually added locations, and today we'll begin serving or having lunches delivered at 33 sites and in the community. For childcare, we've also surveyed our families, and we had 280 families that requested childcare, and we worked with our YMCA and Champions partners to have them use 5 sites within the school district.
Yeah. So that sounds terrific. Are you also still concerned, though, that there might be families that are falling through the cracks right now? Because, I mean, point taken that these are extraordinary times, but it's just not going to be the same as having all the services centralized as they normally are in a school.
That's correct. We hope not. Word of mouth. We'd send pretty much every other day communication to our families. We know many of our families have mobile phones or mobile devices that they're able to access the information. And as we widen the net for distribution for food, we're hopeful that we'll be reaching all families.
So communication being really key here.
It is absolutely key. And in our school district, we speak 94 home languages. So our ability to translate those languages has also been key.
Yeah. And then what about the question of about learning? you talked about moving to online learning. As we were discussing a little earlier, that might work better with some ages than others. So how are you sort of coping across the wide variety of not just ages, but kinds of learners that every school district has?
Well, and that's our challenge each and every day, whether we're in a coronavirus situation or not,
right.
Isn't it? And what we've done is we've actually paused our online learning for this week, and we're moving into a new iteration. As we think about innovation, we're moving into a new iteration, which is project-based week. So we're pushing out resources that enable students to acquire, if you will, knowledge or information, and then we're hoping they'll demonstrate their understanding or applying that knowledge in new and independent ways. And we linked some examples. I was very impressed with the elementary student in Taiwan who created the Lego robot to distribute hand sanitizer. So we're asking students to craft projects or craft ideas that might help us in our community during this time of a health crisis. So we're looking forward to all the different projects, as well as we've reminded students about the importance of reading. Warren Buffett has talked about that in many ways, and we're going to be posting a book review site and creating a North Shore Newbery Award, if you will, having our students share their reviews of different books so we can have a literary conversation as well this week. So we're trying different things and hoping that will engage our learners across the broad spectrum of developmental stages.
Yeah. So one of the things that we hope to provide here on the show as the days and weeks go by is just opportunities for people to connect maybe in different ways. So we've got Dr. Nathaniel Beers here. He's, again, just to remind folks, he's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on School Health. And Dr. Beers, just first of all, like, what are you hearing in Superintendent Reed's story and how the North Shore School District is handling their closure so far?
I mean, I would say, first and foremost, as she highlighted, right, this is more than just about sort of whether or not kids are out of school. It is about the health of the community and making sure that we think about that first and foremost. And so I think the things that they are doing are really exciting to hear around thinking about how they are meeting the needs of their families and also the students. And then taking this opportunity to rethink and reimagine some of the instructional goals that had been in place and how we can achieve those goals. And those are the exact things that we need, you know, for folks. I would say, you know, along those same lines, this is really great opportunity for families to step back and think about, you know, what are they doing around their own sort of digital time and digital access and thinking about how they are really supporting their child's development in this process is something that the American Academy of Pediatrics has been pushing out some additional information around how do you think about digital access during this period of time where there is this increased demand and families also have more free time on their hands. Mm-hmm. And so how do you think through sort of some of those challenges in front of them?
Yeah. Well, Superintendent Reed, I don't know if you do, but do you have any questions or observations for Dr. Beers?
Not at this time.
Okay.
I just appreciate the collaboration, and I think that's one of the things this particular situation really will benefit from is all of us coming together. There's not one solution because there's so many different contexts around the country. I think the only constant is us working together and supporting one another at this time.
Well, do you have any, what's the one piece of advice you'd give to superintendents who are looking at their school closure starting today? What's the sort of, not just the advice, but maybe the news to help keep them going you'd give them?
Right. I think being thoughtful with the adults in the system and thoughtful of the students and our families and just knowing that social distancing is our ability to do our part to combat this current situation.
Well, Michelle Reed is the superintendent of schools for North Shore School District, speaking to us from Kenmore, Washington. Superintendent Reed, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
All right. Well, now let's go to Memphis, Tennessee, where Superintendent Joris Ray joins us. Joris is the superintendent for Shelby County Schools there. They closed district schools from March 13th through March 30th. More than 100,000 students and 200 schools in the district. Nearly 60% of those students are considered economically disadvantaged. And by the way, the schools there are the second largest employer in Shelby County, 14,000 employees, including 6,500 teachers. Superintendent Ray, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing well. First of all, let me ask you, Superintendent, what's the sort of the first set of needs that you're going to have to be filling there for the Shelby County Schools as they're closed down?
You know, we have to fill the needs of children. And many of our children, they don't eat unless they're in school. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we had to do is set up different locations to ensure that our students eat on a daily basis. That's so important. Many of our families, again, live below the poverty line, and we just want to ensure that our students are well nourished over the next few weeks.
Okay, and so are you able to do that? Are you set up for that right now?
Yes, we are. We're setting up with many partners across Shelby County, and to ensure that our students can do what we call a grab and go. They get their lunch and get their meals, and they can continue on. We're working with local churches, businesses here in town. And I just wanted to say how much I appreciate the community for pulling together to ensure that our children are safe and that during these times we really take care of them, because their social emotional needs are paramount.
Yeah. Superintendent Ray, can you talk about that a little bit more? Because I think it's really important, because, you know, schools are, they're the entire world for so many kids, right? It's not just where they get their learning or their food, as you're talking about, but it's their community, it's their social network. So how are you, losing those immediate connections is going to be tough for a lot of kids, even if it's just for a short-ish period of time. So how are you going to take care of those social and emotional needs?
Well, one thing we have to do is educate parents around social emotional learning, and to ensure that they calm fears, keep students away from the television, and we want to fight fear with facts. Just educating our parents. Last night, I sent out a post just telling parents just to hug their children, talk about good times, talk to them about what's actually going on. Because our students, they need to be calm. They need to know that they're loved, but also they need to know it's going to be a brighter day ahead. So we're partnering with Methodist Healthcare here and other partners to really provide their support for our parents, to ensure that our students are just mentally stable so that they feel safe during this tough time.
Mm. Now, Superintendent Ray, if I may ask, Tennessee Governor Bill Lee said he's not going to close all schools across the state. Shelby County went ahead and did it. Are you able to get the supports that you need from the state? Because we're hearing throughout this hour that sort of cooperation and collaboration is key for this to all be successful.
Yes, you're exactly right. I'm in constant communication with our local commissioner of ed and also the governor's office as well. We have to do what's best for our community right here, and they've been very supportive. We had to look at just containing it and being proactive around this virus, working with the local health department here. We just made a move. We thought it was the right move for the students of Shelby County here. And I have a wonderful school board who allows me to lead. So it's about doing what's best for children, and we're always going to do that here. And I just appreciate the community wrapping their arms around us and this community.
Yeah. So we can't say this enough, that people's health and well-being is paramount right now. You know, since we are talking about school children, you know, what about that learning piece? How is that going to be rolled out as kids aren't going to be in the buildings for a couple of weeks?
So we've been looking at this since the probably middle of February, and my team, I've assembled a team, a cross-functional team, to look at just how we're going to tackle this issue. And there's a huge digital divide here in Shelby County. We have devices that are like 2-to-1. So we developed a hybrid system to where we're using project-based learning, but also some students will receive some learning from our News Channel 19 here. But also we have students who does have access to internet. So they'll receive some online learning. So it's a hybrid approach. Of course, this week, this is spring break for us. So we're giving students a break so that they can refresh. But next week, we're going to hit the ground running. So this week, we're in preparation. And with our teams, our curriculum teams, really working hard to develop a plan of action that we can disseminate towards the end of the week. But we're using a project-based approach. We're using online approach, but also we're going to use our radio and TV channels here.
Yeah.
We got to have multiple ways to reach children.
Well, Superintendent Joris Ray is the superintendent for Shelby County Schools in Tennessee. The district closed schools there from March 13th through March 30th. More than 100,000 students and 14,000 employees in the Shelby County School District. Superintendent Ray, thank you so much for all you're doing there for your
yes,
students, families,
you.
And teachers, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Beers, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I've got a lot more questions for you, and we've got callers and another superintendent joining us. So there's a lot more to talk about with the fact that more than half of America's public school children are out of school as school closures take effect across the country to help curb the spread of coronavirus. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about coping with school closures as more than half of public school children in America are out of school today as districts attempt to cope with the coronavirus and practice social distancing so that we can flatten that curve, as they say, to reduce the spread of coronavirus. I'm joined today by Dr. Nathaniel Beers. He's a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on School Health. He's also president of the HSC Healthcare System, which is a subsidiary of Children's National Hospital. They serve kids with complex needs in the Washington, D.C. area. And Dr. Beers, there's something I wanted to just dig into a little bit more with you. And that's, again, this sense of community and belonging that schools provide millions of children every day. It is their world. And so I'm just wondering how to replace, if it's even possible to replace that sense of connectivity if kids can't be in the buildings for a couple of weeks.
I mean, I think it is a really hard challenge, right? I think we don't think about sort of all the times getting to and from school that are part of the community for children. We don't think about all of the sort of spaces in the halls as they transition from class to class that create a community. All of those small connections through the day are lost when they are not in the building. And so how do you create that space and think that through? Certainly, The good part of social media is figuring out how can you use that in a way to maintain social connection, right? So that it can be a positive support to kids in connecting and making sure that we maintain those. I think certainly encouraging kids to still remain active is hard to do. Mm-hmm. And so how can kids get outside, maintain social distance, but still have an opportunity to move in a way that they need to move is important for us to continue to support. And then thinking about how you create some schedules so that there becomes some normalcy. Part of the value of school is around the scheduling that kids get used to and normed in their lives. And so making sure that families are stepping through, thinking about creating a daily schedule so there is a routine. I'm still getting up at a regular time. I'm still getting dressed. I'm having my meal. I'm getting ready for the day. And then how much time am I going to spend doing various activities is a good way to start that with your family. In fact, my family sat down last night and every child in our house had to sort of think through what's their schedule going to be for the day. What are the tasks that they're going to do? How much time are they going to spend reading? How much time are they going to spend being physically active? When are they going to eat lunch? All of those pieces to, again, just make sure that they are still used to it when they return to that regular schedule in their
right.
lives.
Well, and of course, all of this depends on, especially if the kids are younger, having, as we were talking about earlier, an adult present constantly to help, you know, keep those kids on that schedule. That's a big part of this equation about whether families are going to be able to access that kind of care in a time where some folks still are able and have to go to work physically and can't be there. So we'll talk about that in a second, but let's go back to our callers. Let's go to Megan, who's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi, Megna. I am calling to talk a little bit about special education.
Yeah, go ahead.
The first concern is that our students aren't receiving their services, which is very concerning. But the other piece is that as we're moving forward, one of the key questions for eligibility determination is if the students had access consistently to high-quality education. And after this kind of a situation, we're not going to be able to say that with confidence.
Now, so can you decipher that a little bit for us, Megan, for people who don't know what you're talking about, the eligibility?
Sure,
yeah, go ahead.
I work as a school psychologist, so we take data over time about how a student's performing. And if a student has had access to education, so if a student doesn't have consistent education because they don't attend school regularly or there was some kind of interruption, we want to say that was an issue with the curriculum and not an issue with the student having a disability. So we're going to have to really fine-tune down more specifically to try and figure out ways to still give kids support, even if we can't diagnose a specific disability at this time.
I see. Well, Megan, thank you so much for that call and for that insight. Dr. Beers, I mean, it sounds like there's a whole other set of special considerations that have to be made for students with disabilities.
Right. I mean, I think that there is this component of those that are currently eligible and how are you providing services for those kids who are currently eligible and meeting their needs and differentiating the education appropriately for them and then making sure that they are not not missing services that really are critical for their own personal health that they receive at school. And so figuring out which ones of those can transition to home-based services. As this caller noted, right, as students return into school, in determining why is this child behind on their educational progress, is it because they missed 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks of school? Or is it because they truly have a learning disability? And how can you differentiate that when the variability of instruction is so great as kids are out of school? Right. And how can we decrease that issue going forward?
Okay. Well, I want to hear from one more head of a school district this hour. So joining us now is Sonia Brookins-Santelises. She's CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. There are 79,000 students in Baltimore and 161 schools. They have been closed now, and slightly more than half of those students are considered economically disadvantaged. So, Sonia Brookins-Santelises, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So, first of all, can you just give us a little bit of insight into how long Baltimore City schools might be closed?
So as of now, officially, what the state superintendent and governor have announced is we are officially closed through the end of March. But I, like many of my colleagues, are putting plans in place for longer than that, just given some of the direction that this, you know, that this health emergency is presenting. But
right.
as of right now, it's to the end of the month.
So can you talk to us then about some of the plans that you're putting into place because of and what it's going to take to meet the needs of the students in Baltimore?
Well, and I think like a number of my colleagues, you know, including Dr. Ray, who you just had on from Shelby County, we are following suit. In a matter of fact, today is the first day of our district feeding program for our young people who are now not going to be in school. So we have 10 of our schools that have been designated as feeding sites. Our recreation and parks colleagues within City Hall are also partnering with us. So we have another 40 to 50 recreation centers across the city that are also opening to provide meals to young people across the city. We are also today school leaders are preparing to receive families tomorrow to pick up, you know, again, some of the same work packets. They will be for young people to help with that continuum of learning, so at-home learning activities. We also are posting online. I already have some city schools teachers who, who on social media and things are already contacting students and doing some FaceTiming. But as a district, what we are, you know, really engaged in now is very similar to my colleagues across the country. And how do we keep a learning trajectory engagement going? As Dr. Beers said just recently, this idea of routine, particularly for young people who are already, you know, living in situations, you know, they're already living in under-resourced mm-hmm. communities. And so then the need to provide some of those supports to them and their families is of heightened importance and priority for us.
So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about student safety. Because I mean, in there are certain neighborhoods, certain places where school is the safest place for kids to be, and
right.
and if they can't be in the building, I mean, how are you coping around concerns around that?
Yeah, so some of our concerns around that are that part of what's unchartered territory for us, at least recently, is, you know, for a lot of our young people, when they're not in school, they can go to, again, community centers, recreation centers, the library. Our partners at Enoch Pratt are wonderful partners usually, but now because of the social distancing that we need to do, those resources, community resources, are now not readily available. So again, it becomes more important to have, you know, more innovative ways of trying to engage young people. The other piece that we are very mindful of is, you know, and we know developmentally, and I'm sure, you know, Dr. Beers can talk about this as well, but, you know, developmentally, when you have early adolescents and adolescents who just need a different level of engagement and have a different propensity towards social gathering, there is a good amount of concern about as this health emergency extends beyond, you know, a week or two, what do we need to have in place beyond what, you know, what we're currently working on to help support them? And that does become a safety issue, as well as young people who whose parents are on the front line, whose mm-hmm. family members and caregivers are on the front line. So I do know that our state superintendent, we have a conference call with my colleagues this afternoon to talk about what are the emergency child care provisions that we're putting in place within each local jurisdiction. So that is also a concern.
Okay. Well, I mean, and a big one, right? Because of not just for the families with adults on the front line, but there are probably, I can imagine, many families who who, for as long as their businesses are staying open, they cannot afford to not work. And so where are they going to get the child care?
No, that is absolutely. And I will say, as the governor and state superintendent made the announcement last week, it was already a discussion amongst myself and my colleagues across the state. So we are in communication around that. Hopefully, we will have some plans in place that you know we've been working on. But it's going to have to be a full community effort. And I think one of the things we're finding in this is that schools are clearly an anchor in this discussion, but it really does need to be a community effort. And so particularly when we're talking about child care for first responders and, to your point, others who have to work, then it becomes even more important for the community to look at every resource. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Sonia Brookins Santelizes is the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck to you.
No, thank you, and thank you for getting the word out.
Let's go back to our calls. Let's go to Mandy, who's calling from Hallowell, Maine. Mandy, you're on the air.
Hello. How are you, Magda?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing, Mandy?
I'm doing well. Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm going to be asking that question of everybody for the next many weeks, okay?
So. That's right. How are you doing? How are you feeling?
Yeah.
Healthy today. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm calling in. I've liked hearing a lot of the things that I've heard today on your show, and I just wanted to respond sort of in reference to students coming home and being home starting today. We at first thought that today was just going to be an isolated day, and then just yesterday we got a letter from our district, and we have a 2-week at home time for our students, and I imagine it will probably turn into more than 2 weeks. But I've received information from at least, well, I have 3 children, from one of my kids' teachers, and I just feel like there should be more of an emphasis on, less of an emphasis on the education and instruction piece, because I think we should get down to bare bones a little bit more. And I like that a lot of people are focusing on feeding kids, students out there in the community, and finding a safe place and belonging for those kids, like someone was speaking about earlier on the show. Because while the instruction and the education is so important and we don't want that to slip, I don't want any of those teachers, my kids' teachers or anyone, to feel like they aren't doing their job when they're not allowed to go into the schools.
Right.
I feel like they need to be able to go home to their families and reach out to their relatives wherever they are and take care of themselves as well.
Well, Mandy, I'm going to take it back from you there because we're just running out of time on the show today. But thank you so much for that call and observing that the teachers have families, too, that they need to look after in these extraordinary times of ours. I'm just seeing here, by the way, about that academic piece here, that Texas officials are canceling high-stakes testing for the 2019-2020 school year. That's from the Dallas Morning News. And also, by the way, circling back to Tennessee, Governor Lee is urging all schools in Tennessee now to be closed by Friday. So Shelby County was ahead of the curve there with Superintendent Ray. Now, Dr. Beers, we've got a minute and a half left here, and I'm just curious. Thank you so much for your patience and as we sort of reach out across the country here. But you led the D.C. Health Department for schools during the H1N1 crisis. Does this compare at all? Were there any lessons that you learned from that that can be applied to the moment that school districts across the country are facing now?
I would say certainly a lot of the school districts have learned since then. And I think that what you're seeing a lot of right now is school districts really trying to be proactive in communication with families to make sure that they feel safe in sending their child to school. So before all the closures started, I think there were a lot of school districts around this area, and as well as those that I was monitoring on the national scale, that were making sure that families had as much information as they could and acknowledged that it was moving very quickly. And that is really critical for families so that they can plan it and ahead with their child and for their family and for the broader community.
Well, Dr. Nathaniel Beers, member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on School Health and president of the HSC healthcare system, which helps serve kids with complex needs in the Washington, D.C. area. Dr. Beers, thank you so very much for being our guide this hour.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, folks, for tomorrow's show, we are going to be talking about the importance of expertise and the, over the past many years, the growing distrust of expertise in America. So if you've got thoughts or questions about that, leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.